Brexit 10 years ago now. Who would have thought that the City of London would be in such a strong position today? I think the City of London as a whole has done a fantastic job about reinventing its position in the global economy today. And for us as a business, like any business, we just sort of follow where the markets are. You mentioned earlier, you know, follow the capital. We follow the capital. London is one of the biggest, brightest, most exciting financial centres of the world. So it's a hugely important market for us, but also a very successful market for all investors. Any global organisation, be it an asset manager, private equity firm, large corporate, investment bank, you name it, nobody would think seriously about not having a presence in London.
Franz Kafka observed a lawyer is a person who writes a 10,000-word document and calls it a brief. Yet good lawyers and good law firms are essential to society's functioning and linchpins of the commercial and financial worlds. At the elevated levels of this profession, there exists a small cadre of highly respected firms whose skills, experience, insight and judgments make them essential ingredients of the most complex transactions. So for the first time in our 6 years' existence, the Money Maze podcast wanted to dive into this still somewhat opaque world in line with our mission to demystify areas of business and finance vital to us all. And to help with this cross-examination, we're delighted to welcome the head of one of those top firms, Alan Mason, managing partner at Freshfields. Alan, welcome to the Money Maze podcast.
Thank you, Simon. It's very nice to be here.
Well, it's taken you a little time to get you here. You're obviously in great demand. And I sat next to you at a Freshfields dinner last year, where I had been invited to interview General Richard Sheriff, former Deputy Supreme Command Allied Commander. And we talked about, or rather he talked about, the similarities and dissimilarities of being a World War II soldier versus being in Ukraine today. And you then shared some valuable insights about your world, which, of course, led us to today's conversation. I think perhaps the fact you arrived yesterday from the US and you have relocated to the US from the UK talks a lot about Freshfields' global ambitions, to which we will return. But to begin proceedings, was there anything when you were growing up that would have suggested a career in law?
Lots of legal references there in the introduction, so very impressive. Thank you for that. Probably more than I was having when I was growing up, actually. I did not grow up wanting to be a lawyer, which is probably a good thing, I would imagine. I'm not sure many kids grew up dreaming of becoming a lawyer. It's something that came to me relatively late, and I was more interested. I actually studied more economics when I was younger. I studied law at university, but before then, more interested in the business and finance side of things, and came into law really as a sort of way into the business world, which many people do, but I guess I'm not a lawyer's lawyer in that respect.
So let's pause on education. You actually studied in London and Paris.
Indeed.
I can't resist the reference to Dickens' great work, A Tale of Two Cities, where it is written that London, when people have described the book, is typified by order, law, restraint, and class rigidity. And Paris,
where's this going?
Paris by passion, violence, revolution, energy, and oppression. Which of those Parisian experiences resonated with you?
So I think you just summed up my career and my personality there on both sides. A confused kid or a confused lawyer today. No, I love London. I get back here as often as I can. In fact, I spent until I relocated to the US in 2020. Before then, I'd spent 25 years living in Paris. So I spent the vast majority of my career at Freshfields in Paris. I'm a French citizen. But obviously, UK citizen as well, grew up in the UK, moved there, age sort of 18, 20, and been there ever since, other than regular visits back to the UK and then relocating to the US. So I feel very much at ease in both Paris and London. I think that's a nice summary of both cities. I like both sides of them.
So before we get to law, if I've understood it correctly, you joined Goldman's for a year as well. And people have said that you found it quite a formative experience. Just shine the light on that.
So I was immensely privileged to... I love what I do, and I find myself to be incredibly lucky to in everything that I've done. And I always sort of see opportunities and just seize them and see what happens. Goldman was very much one of those. I was there in 2004, 2005 in Paris and in London. And I basically spent just over a year working in their sort of legal department, also with the investment bankers, looking after all of their own account type of transactions in Paris. At the time, they had three senior MDs and partners who were all former lawyers. And I think that scared the Goldman management as to what they could get up to. So they sent me there to keep an eye on what was going on. And I think it's fair to say I went native on the first day and had the time of my life. I loved every minute of it.
Well, I went to a lunch the other day where Lloyd Blankfein was unveiling his new book, Getting To and Through Goldman Sachs. And I did say to him, he and I had something in common because we'd both been rejected by Goldman's. He got in through Jay Aron and Co., which was the commodity firm they merged with.
I've just finished reading his book. It's very good.
It is. It's excellent. So a quick shout out of him. Let's talk about the industry, your industry, the law industry, at a high level. Firms like, you know, Freshfields, Linklaters, Clifford Chance trace their roots back to the 18th century. You know, they were built on finance and government relationships. And the US firms like Sullivan and Cromwell and Skadden emerged in the 20th century, often tied to Wall Street. And the UK's partnership structure, you know, has maybe hindered in some cases in that competitive race that is US firms and their global expansion versus the UK. But just give us a sense of how you would describe the landscape, high level, of the bigger law firms.
It's a great question. I think it's particularly relevant at the moment because the sort of the world order, as it were, of the legal world is sort of being turned upside down very much in a way the other aspects of the global economy and geopolitical situation are as well. I think it's fair to say that the sort of modern law firm was built, developed sort of back in the 60s. Sherman Sterling, as it was then, was probably the first sort of corporate firm to come together or understand that it was important to bring together all aspects of what a company needed to advise it through various aspects of its life cycle. And so that's going back sort of 60 odd years. Interestingly, Wachtell, one of the most well-regarded law firms in the world, was also created about 60 years ago. So I guess what we're seeing right now is a sort of the next phase or the next chapter of a constantly evolving industry. What's happening at the moment, though, is we're really seeing what I would describe as the sort of true globalization of the legal industry. Until relatively recently, probably the global financial crisis, I think it's fair to say that the US firms were traditionally very much focused on the US market because it's such a large domestic market, still the biggest market for lawyers in the world. And the firms such as ourselves were very much focused on what we used to call the international market, which was basically outside of the US. So we built up in the sort of 80s, 90s and 2000s, our amazing European network. We expanded in Asia, the Middle East, etc. But we're very sort of had a presence in the US, but it was very limited in the same way many of our US competitors had a very small presence in Europe. Get to the global financial crisis and coming out of that, there's really sort of, I think, the breaking down of the barriers between the US and the rest of the world. Arguably for, again, the economy as well, not just the legal profession. And since then, we've seen the two markets converge into one global market where the US is a very strong market. And therefore, the firms that are strong in the US have a very good presence, or that gives them a great platform to be well positioned to service their clients globally. We would argue, of course, that we have we have other advantages, which is the strength of our mainly the strength of our global platform outside of the US. And as we continue to expand in the US, we now have over 500 lawyers in the US, over 115 partners in the US. So as we continue to expand in that market, then that really amplifies all the strengths we have elsewhere. So it's really the key point, I guess, is the globalization of the legal market.
Right. And you've slightly answered my next question, which was to give us a brief, but just give us Freshfields' size, shape, footprint.
Yeah.
In totality.
So 490 partners globally. In addition to that, around 2,000 lawyers. So call it, 2,500 lawyers between partners, counsel and associates around the world. Our largest office is London still. We have a very strong presence on the continent. And as I said, now the US is our second largest part of our business globally.
IFM Investors is a global asset manager, founded and owned by pension funds with capabilities in infrastructure equity and debt, private equity, private credit, and listed equities. They believe healthy returns depend on healthy economic, environmental, and social systems, and these are evolving on a scale never experienced before. To find opportunity, build value, and meet the needs of future generations, you need scale, skill, and expertise. That's what IFM Investors has built up over 30 years. My Name Is podcast is sponsored by JP Morgan Asset Management, Europe's leading active ETF provider by assets under management. With over 40 ETFs powered by active research covering all major equity and fixed income markets, JP Morgan's ETF solutions are designed to meet the needs of today's investors. Whether you're navigating market volatility, in need of an income upgrade, or targeting long-term capital growth, JP Morgan Asset Management is the home of active ETFs. Search JP Morgan Active ETF or find out more by tapping the link in the episode description. When you invest, your capital is at risk. And I was thinking of parallels because, you know, having grown up and seen the Warburgs, Schroders, Barings, yeah. Flemings disappear through consolidations, are we seeing essentially, you know, with now Goldman's, Morgan Stanley, JP being the predominant financial firms, is this sort of the same playbook playing out in law firms?
I think we are seeing consolidation of the legal market. At the moment, we're seeing it at two levels, mainly consolidation of talent. So we see in other professional services industries, senior bankers moving between banks. We are seeing a lot of senior lawyers moving between law firms. But also we're beginning to see some mergers of some law firms. We haven't, obviously, the biggest one most recently would be Sherman and Sterling and Allen and Overy, so A&O Sherman. But other than that, we've seen sort of medium-sized firms merging. So yes, there's consolidation. I think there is a sense that in the coming years, we will have fewer bigger law firms servicing their clients. And that's, I don't think that's just the legal industry talking to itself. I think it's, talking to ourselves. I think that's really a factor of what our clients are demanding. They want their business, the business environment for clients is getting increasingly complex. It may sound strange or counterintuitive, but as the world around us becomes more complex and more fragmented, in fact, it requires, in our view, sort of bigger and more complex global law firms because you need to help navigate clients around different legal regimes and regulations globally. Therefore, you need more people in more places to help our clients.
Can you maybe give us an example, a corporate example, you know, of where that manifests itself?
Well, take, for example, I'm based in the US, I'm based in San Francisco, is my home office, as it were. Take the big tech companies. One of the biggest issues for big tech companies at the moment is navigating supply chain issues and regulation in China and Asia, but also European regulation and following Brexit, UK regulation on top of that. So for a company or an industry such as the tech industry that's based in Silicon Valley, that's got nothing to do with directly Asia or Europe, two of the biggest issues that with which they're confronted today, basically other sides of the world, we need to be able to serve it, to support our clients on those issues for them.
Okay.
In addition to working with them there, so that requires us to be in all of these places.
Right. My understanding is that essentially top law firms track global trade flows.
Yes.
And, you know, although we're going to talk about a bit more about the US, you know, in a minute, you know, I think it was, you know, Peter Frankopan, when he was, you know, a guest, said, you know, 68% of the world's population lives east of Istanbul. And, you know, one doesn't hear so much about legal practice in Asia. Mm-hmm. Is that because they're just lots of homegrown, you know, lawyers speaking the sort of the domestic language?
So Asia is a great market. I was there a couple of weeks ago. We've got a great business in Asia. We're very positive. We think the outlook in Asia is really, really strong. It's difficult because we talk about Asia, but in fact, there are so many different markets, as you say. Mainland China, obviously the biggest market in terms of population, but it's very difficult for, there are lots of law firms there. Regulations are very restricted in what we can and can't do there. And in fact, unless you're a local law firm, you can't actually practice. So when we think about Asia, we see lots of opportunities for the future. And we have presence, you know, we have offices across Vietnam, Singapore, mainland China, Hong Kong, Tokyo, etc. So we're very present in that part of the world. But the opportunities are different, and there's lots of local competition as well.
Right. So let's go back to the US. As you said, biggest legal market, you know, in the world. You go there because Freshfields wants to grow its footprint, but you obviously go there to set an example, or at least tell me why you felt it was important to move there?
It's both a question of sort of sending a message, but also, frankly, just so much of our business is, the US is relevant to so many of our clients and so many aspects of our business that it's easier to be on the ground, just working day in, day out, seeing clients, understanding what their issues are, understanding the legal market, understanding what our partners and associates are thinking, doing, the firms they come from. So yeah, it's just, it's think of, if you think of an investment bank or any one of our clients, you wouldn't try and sort of grow in a different market without being very, you know, very strong and present on the ground. So that's what we've done. And it happened to be me. It could have been anybody. It's really a question of just when you're trying to build a business in a market, you want to be there day in, day out on the ground, working side by side with the teams on the ground and the clients on the ground as well.
And the West Coast specific, it's a long way away, but you know, we all know the dynamism there. We had Michael Morris the other day talking about just what it is that the West Coast has. But just again, explain, because that would, as an outsider, I would think, well, that gives quite a big tech slant to your business. But is that too simplistic?
No, look, the West Coast is very much about tech and life sciences, and tech, both of those industries are, again, driving the global economy. When you look at the weight in the US economy of the seven big tech companies, it's absolutely huge. But we are living through right now something that's bigger than the dot-com boom, the AI boom, and just frankly, putting to one side the firm and business, it's just fascinating to be on the ground and seeing these companies grow so fast and change, have such a fundamental impact on the business world, but on society. I think to have a first sort of first row seat of that is just brilliant. I love it.
I mean, we ask a lot of people who come on the show about the comparison of the US and Europe, including the UK, and all the well-documented reasons of, call it eurosclerosis or frustrations to implement, you know, even 10 of the Draghi reports, sort of, you know, recommendations. You're dealing with these enterprises, you know, all the time. Mm-hmm. You know, are we being too negative on Europe's prospects?
Look, Europe is a fantastic market, great talent. There is, I think, the West Coast in particular, to answer the question through that lens to start with, has a huge advantage in just the concentration of talent and capital in the same place. Across Europe, we have amazing investors and universities and talent across the UK, across in Brussels, across Germany, Berlin, Paris, etc. But there's not one hub that can really consolidate and bring together the same investment community and the same sort of engineering talent pool. So I think that's one advantage. I think also the pace of change is incredibly fast in the US. It's move quickly, break things, move on when that happens to the next idea. I think sometimes we feel more nervous about moving quickly in Europe. We want to get things right first, and then we do it, as opposed on the West Coast, there's a lot of sort of, I guess, design or development through trial and error. But I think Europe has a fantastic outlook. It's just a question of how we can unlock a lot of the potential we have over here.
So let's just stay with this idea of you going to the US because there is a mission, which is clearly, you know, growing Freshfields US as well as its global presence. Mm. Now, I think it was Richard Branson who said that every success story is a tale of constant adaptation, revision and change. And, you know, I've read and spoken to people who say that when firms, law firms, have tried this move, there is an investment that is required. Mm-hmm. That might mean that partner compensation in the London office isn't what it might otherwise have been, because there's a wider goal. How have you managed the cultural challenges?
Sure. Look, building any business always requires investments, and we are a partnership still, and therefore we have to have buy-in from the partners across the world in London, but elsewhere as well. It's got to be something that everybody in the firm, all the partners of the firm, are behind. And the reason why I think that is the case for us is, first of all, I think the mindset of the partners in the firm, we're very, very globally minded. We love this idea of working with like-minded colleagues across the world. We love getting our teeth into really challenging questions for our clients, and the most difficult questions invariably involve legal issues in other countries as well. I was very lucky in that when I started the firm, it was the back end of the build out of our European network, and we were doing exactly the same thing. When we could deal with a particular issue in the UK, We were excited about how would that issue get solved in Italy, in Spain, in Germany. So there's a sort of, it's a core part of our DNA, I guess, is to think globally about issues. But then also, I think just the reality is what we're doing in the US is not trying to build a standalone US business. We're trying to build a global business that reflects the footprint of the global economy and what our clients need. And of course, the US is a big part of that. It's not the only part. So by doing what we're doing, we're also creating more opportunities for our partners and our clients in Europe, because by having a stronger bench in the US, we can do more work in Europe, for example, with US clients. As I mentioned earlier, the US tech clients, fantastic. By having a presence there, we can do more work for them in Europe as well as working with them over there.
So, Alan, before we leave the US, you know, let's just reflect on how you would, what's your scorecard to date? I mean, was it staying an Englishman in New York? Well, I know you're in San Francisco. Just give us a sense of how you feel you've been accepted moving forward.
Yeah. So look, I don't think, like, generally it's not in my personality to do things half-heartedly. So when I went there, I decided there's no point in going there as a tourist, and I went all in. So, but I moved to the US during COVID, which was not a great time to move. As a result of that, I started in California, because I moved there in the winter of 2020, and you couldn't go, you couldn't sit in restaurants at the time, and it seemed like a more sensible thing to do to be in California eating outside than in New York. But as a result of that, I found myself in this bizarre situation where I'd just been appointed managing partner of the firm in September 2020. And in order to move to the US, I had to, or to California at least, I had to sit the California bar and re-qualify or train as a US lawyer. So I remember going out the night I'd been appointed as the global managing partner to celebrate that. And then thinking, wow, it's a whole new life out there ahead of me, getting up at 6 o'clock the following morning, getting the law books out again that I hadn't done for 25 years, and learning all about California law. So that's a bit of an indication that I don't look at myself as an Englishman in New York or California. I look at myself as a European who's adapted to the US and loving it out there.
And if you were characterising one essential difference between working in the US versus working in Europe?
I could offend Europeans and Americans in one sentence.
Well, that
here
was what I hoped
so
you
I
might
have
do
to be very careful with my answer, but at the same time, not be too diplomatic. No, I think, so going back to where you started about the tale of two cities between Paris and London, and picking up on what King Charles said, I think at the citing the famous quotation about Americans and the Americans and the British being two nations divided by a common language. I do think, bizarrely, that when I'm in America and working with our US colleagues and US clients, I do think I personally, it's more my French personality that comes out, more direct. You could say, obnoxious.
Brusque. Brusque is a French word, I think.
Exactly. So there is certainly a side of me that it's helpful to have a different sort of way of thinking about things in Europe rather than a purely British way going to America, because I think there are lots of differences there.
In times of economic and geopolitical volatility, investors will look to gold. Today, as the world navigates uncertainty and heightened risk, investors of all sorts will look to safeguard their wealth. We're thrilled to welcome the World Gold Council as one of our sponsors. Tap the link in the show notes to learn more, or visit goldhub.org on your browser for comprehensive research, insights, and analysis on the global gold market. The Money Maze podcast is proudly sponsored by the London Stock Exchange Group, a global leader in financial markets infrastructure. LSEG has a rich history of facilitating capital flows, empowering businesses, and connecting investors to opportunities. Today, they provide world-class technology, data, and analytics, playing a critical role in shaping modern finance. From their role in sustainable investing to their contributions to financial innovation, LSEG is helping to build a more connected and efficient markets. visit lseg.com via the link in the show notes to see how they're driving the future of finance. So the cultural sort of cohesion, or at least the challenge of growing a business, particularly on two sides of the, you know, of the Atlantic, is not to be underestimated. What would you say have been the lever or levers that have been most effective in, you know, in building culture and reinforcing, you know, the virtue of a great firm?
Look, there, right now, I think that's another thing that's happening in the legal industry, because if you step back and look at what's happening across the legal world at the moment, it's very similar, I believe, to what happened in previous decades across, and you mentioned the investment banking community, but when you look at what's happened in investment banking, in management consultancy, in accountants, you've seen the sort of professionalization of traditional partnership models, sort of the corporatization, if you were, of the traditional partnership model. And the legal profession is having a bit of a moment like that as well at the moment. So there are two ways to get things done in a law firm. You can lead a law firm in sort of more of a corporate direction, where your partners are, in effect, highly paid senior executives like managing directors in investment bank. Or you can hang on to the more traditional partnership model, where partners are also owners of the business and therefore have a say in the decisions of that are made by the firm. Some of our competitors have leaned more into the first example, going down a more corporate command and control. So I come in and say, we're going to the US and, you know, that's what we're doing, take it or leave it. That's not the route we went down. That's not who we are as a firm. That's not our culture, our identity. We've gone down the, let's talk amongst ourselves, let's explain the business opportunity, let's explain the rationale, let's explain the strategy, and let's bring people along on the journey. So arguably our approach can sometimes take a little bit longer because it requires a little bit more time to build consensus around an idea. But once the idea has landed, as it were, then suddenly you have, in my example, 490 partners on board with the idea. And that's incredibly powerful when you have people actually bought into what the firm's trying to do.
Very clear. Let's come back to the clients. You're operating at this high level with top institutions. And the mystique, I think, to the outsider is, what's the advice that is most valued by those clients?
That's a great question. Secret sauce of any law firm or any organization. So what makes us special? No, what our clients are looking for is, I believe, three things. It's a mixture of course, legal advice. We're here to get the law right. And that involves doesn't involve answering theoretical questions. It means actually advising them on how they can conduct their business in a way that, I guess, strikes the right balance for them in terms of risk and reward. So identifying the risks, advising on how to manage the risks. And that can be event-driven. That could be a piece of litigation. It could be a transaction, a piece of M&A, etc. Or just, what is the outlook in the industry and how do they need to start thinking about changing regulations to comply with the law? So first of all, the first part is very much getting the legal advice right in a practical way. But secondly, it's beyond that. It's exceptional client service. So we're in the service industry, like the other professional services that I've mentioned. So making sure that we are there by our client's side 24/7 when it matters the most to them. And then third, and this is, I think, something that's happened really, again, in more recently, it's making sure that we are providing advice that is relevant to them from an industry point of view. So if I'm advising a tech client, I do that in a very different way than if I'm advising an investment bank or a traditional, you know, chemicals company, because they're going to have different issues. They're going to care less about certain points. They're going to care more about other points. So by advising our clients through an industry lens as well, I think we make the advice we give them more relevant. So it's legal, it's client service, and it's industry relevant.
And the other thing that sort of jumps out at me is that if, and I may have this wrong, but if Freshfields Advise, Blackstone, Carlyle, Warburg Pincus, General Atlantic, you know, somebody who spent time at Morgan Stanley where there was always this conversation about conflict of interest, how do you manage the fact that you are advising competitive institutions day in, day out?
Yeah, and look, it's at the heart of our profession. So again, I go back to an industry that's going through this change, becoming more and more business focused, trying to run ourselves more as an industry, more and more like a business, we have to remember at the heart and the core of what we do, we are a profession providing a service, and we have ethical standards, of which conflicts of interest are probably one of the most important. So we have an incredibly talented and global business, what we call business acceptance team, that advises us from, we look at this through two layers. One, what are we technically allowed to do? And then secondly, from a commercial point of view, how do we manage competing commercial interests? So, but really we have a team that manages this for us. And we sort of decide up front strategically, what clients are we trying to develop? Where do we want to position the business? And we have to make decisions that reflect that.
So I listened to Mike Bloomberg a while back say about data, that if you can't measure it, you can't manage it. A lot of talk about productivity, but partner, etc. When you look at the data, what really matters to you?
It's a great question, because there are so many different data points today, and where the industry is going through a phase as well, where we're trying to, everybody's talking about data as an asset, which I'm always a little bit suspicious of jargon like that, because when you start digging, it's not exactly clear what people really mean. I think like every law firm has their own metrics. What I personally look at is how much, basically how much revenue is everybody generating, not for themselves, but for the firm. So metrics that cut sort of revenue in different ways, and then divide it by the number of people you need to produce it. That for me is a very good indication of not so much our productivity, but are we aligning what we're doing to what our clients want? So if you see that it's, if you see a fast growing part of the business, it means that what we're doing is that's a demand driven sort of growth spurt, as it were. And that's for me, a good sign of the health of the business, because it shows that we're thinking ahead, we're thinking about what our clients need, and therefore, we're doing something right. And then, of course, you look at how you turn that into profitability, et cetera. But I'm sure we come onto this as well. But when you look at the change in technology, AI, et cetera, some of the traditional metrics are going to be changed very, very quickly.
Well, you knew that was my next question, because it is the segue. It is the segue, and I can't imagine that you were asked any question more than the one about AI as a lawyer. So can I possibly have an original question? The answer is, of course, no. But could you just maybe start by saying how it has already improved productivity?
Yeah, so I think, look, right now we're still at the start of the AI journey. And I certainly don't believe anybody who tells me that they know where this is going and what the sort of end game is going to be. So I think we are going to continue to see significant improvements in productivity as we go on. We're already starting to see them, but I guess the first point is, what do we really mean by productivity improvements? And I don't think, what we're not seeing at the moment are many examples of doing the same task more quickly and stopping there. What we are seeing is doing some tasks more quickly, and then with that, going on to do more things, more interesting analysis of the data that we're seeing, so we can provide a better service. So by way of example, I can go through, I used to be able to ask somebody to do some research on cases to try and find some trends, and then provide advice to our clients on the basis of those trends. Right now, with AI, I can look at every single case that's ever been decided on any particular topic. So I get almost perfect information on that. But then I can start then going deeper in my analysis to say, okay, in order to avoid the same things happening to our clients, what do they need to be doing to get ahead of the issues that were decided by those cases? So at the moment, what we're seeing is actually it's giving us the ability to provide more services and better quality advice to our clients, because the industry is still figuring out what it is that we're going to be doing with all this sort of compute power being brought to the legal profession. If I look at what does it mean to be a lawyer, and how have we traditionally operated, we've taken data and knowledge, sort of raw data and knowledge, we've added humans onto that to repackage that, analyze it and repackage it in a way that then we can deliver or turn into a service we can deliver to our client. More and more, I think over the next phase, what we will see is the sort of human element of that, the middle part of the sandwich, as it were, sort of being less relevant in some respects. So the clients being able to take the raw data and the knowledge, and they can have access to the same information we can have. But that, so our profession will evolve, because we will then be doing different things, providing different services to our clients on the basis of the information that they also have access to. And we've recently signed, last year we signed a strategic partnership with Google to help develop different tools, or take their tools for us to develop new products for our clients. And a couple of weeks ago, we've signed a new agreement, a partnership again with Anthropic, to do the same thing using Claude. So we're really excited about these new tools coming out from big tech companies, and also some of the more specialist legal tech companies, because we think they give us the ability to do more things for our clients.
So correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding is you, along with all the other law firms, as a result of, I'm going to say broadly AI, don't need to hire as many graduates. And my question is, whilst that is, a progression, maybe with a small p, is that if you're a client 5 years hence, fewer lawyers have gone through the learning experience of making mistakes because they've been able to hit the, give me the answer button. Is that actually not going forwards?
So I certainly think we need, we're doing a lot of work thinking about what type of lawyers we need for the future. What skill sets do we need? We've recently entered also into a partnership with King's College in London to give all of our graduate recruits the opportunity to do an LLM there on AI in the law, for example, because we know that the sort of partners such as myself, it will take us longer to get our heads around new technologies. We want all of our young lawyers joining the firm to be trained in using AI in the law. So I'm an M&A and private equity partner, and I learnt my profession sitting in dark rooms all night, reviewing contracts and doing due diligence and writing reports. I'm not sure that made me necessarily a better lawyer, but that's certainly how my generation learnt learnt our profession. The next generation will be doing that differently, because a lot of the grind work that we used to do, and we called it experience, will be done by technology and different tools. We just have to make sure that we're giving our young lawyers the opportunity to gain the experience in a different way, arguably more interesting, more useful, possibly quicker as well than the way I learned the way I gained my experience.
Which begs the question of, what are the characteristics you're looking for in a new legal hire?
So I think curiosity, ability to adapt, move quickly, adopt new ways of working. Those are some of the core characteristics that we can then, over time, through working on various mandates, transactions, cases, you then develop the experience that you need to finally acquire what ultimately our clients come to us for, which is judgment. Okay, so judgment will still be an absolutely essential element of the legal profession. But again, I learned judgment from my experience of sitting in dark rooms reviewing paper files. A younger generation will acquire experience in different ways, I think better and less soul-destroying in many ways.
We can't leave the industry that you specialise in without asking PE more than M&A. Private markets have exploded. We all know what's happened. There's a sort of a cloud is hanging over, certain parts of the polite way might be indigestion, and the other thing might be too much capital trashes returns. How would you characterize the world of private assets today?
So not specific to the legal market, more generally.
Absolutely.
So I think there's clearly more private capital out there than ever before. looking to be deployed, as you say, and maybe the market is going through a period of indigestion. But I don't think that I'm not expecting there to be a swing back to sort of the dominance of the public markets we've had for many decades. I think private capital, private assets and public markets, the balance between the two is here to stay. I think it's, again, a logical consequence of what we saw happening in coming out of the global financial crisis, a shift of capital away from the more highly regulated public markets into less regulated private markets. So I think that is absolutely logical to be where we are today. I think it's set to stay. But over time, possibly some of the private markets will become more regulated and you'll see perhaps more of a balancing out and arguably some more convergence between the two.
Okay, which actually leads us into this section of our interview called the Outsiders Inquiry, where we go out and we find some questions from people that you may or may not know.
Any competitors in there?
And no, we didn't, in this case. So the first one is actually from Rob Rooney, who was CEO of Morgan Stanley International. He says, My sense is big law firms' fees and compensation has outpaced everyone except the PE crowd over the last decade. Do they owe this an extraordinary expansion to the post-GFC global regulatory climate? And if so, will it continue?
So I think there is probably a reset going on at the moment. So the last big sort of moment of disruption across the market was the global financial crisis. We're coming up for close to 20 years on now. And I think when you see everything that's going on in the world, in the economy, geopolitically, that it does feel as though we're going through a bit of a reset moment, and there's no reason why the legal profession will be sort of an exception to that. I think the legal profession has perhaps over the last 20 years been a bit of has been an exception to the general rule about some other industries have been impacted. I think the legal industry has been rather insulated from some of the challenges that have been going on, and I'm not sure that will continue to be the case.
Second question is from Hardy McLean, former managing partner at CVC. He said, work hours at elite law firms are insane. How does the new generation react to that? And if their hours get cut, do total billings drop?
I think going back to the previous conversation, AI is the way you square that circle. Because how you would do it otherwise, in a pre-AI world, it's pretty simple. It requires a minimum number of hours. So the question from private equity deals, for us to be able to get absolutely everything right and provide the service that our clients require, takes a minimum number of hours. You can't cut any corners. Clients don't come to us to get it just about okay. They come to us because they know we're going to get it absolutely right. The traditional model has been relatively small teams running very, very hard at transactions. That is changing again because as AI comes on, a lot of the manual tasks that take a lot of time will be able to be automated to a certain extent. They will still have to be checked.
Who was your great mentor and how do you encourage good mentorship as opposed to mentorship?
Yeah, I think we all need careers. We have very long careers, and having somebody or multiple people who, as it were, look out for us is incredibly important. And mentorship is not just about looking out for us. It's actually taking the time to provide advice, going out of your way to put yourself in the other person's shoes, think about what they're going through, picking them up when they're feeling down, advising them when they're on a high. It is a very, very time-intensive exercise, but one that's immensely rewarding. I've been lucky enough to have a few mentors in my career. The one who jumps out most of all, and probably why I'm here today, is now Sir Edward Braham, the former senior partner of the firm and now the chair of a FTSE 100 company, M&G, who was the first partner I started working with when I joined Freshfields almost 30 years ago. He knew that I'd studied in France and I was half French, and he walked into my office on the first day. He was working on a very big French transaction or a big transaction in France, and dumped some papers on my desk saying, "You're the French guy, aren't you? Hey, have a look at that." And we spent the next 7 years working together and kept in contact ever since. And he's always been somebody who I've turned to for advice, but also who's gone out of his way to offer up his advice spontaneously.
And the last in this section was from the co-founder of the Money Maze podcast, Will Campion. He says, "When might law firms need external capital, and is an IPO ever a route that some might consider?"
Great question. One that comes up a lot. And going back to Lloyd's book earlier, obviously he describes the Goldman IPO in a lot of detail. That was needed for very specific reasons because they were worried about their capital position. We don't have the same constraints from that in that respect. We don't have as a legal industry, we don't have huge capex requirements. I often get the question, don't you need to take private equity capital or external capital to invest in AI? At the moment, that's not the case. That's not how the model is evolving. You could see, though, as the profession continues to professionalize or become more and more business focused, like again the investment banking community, like management consultants, like accountants, maybe the legal profession becomes more like the same. And then why wouldn't we take external capital? Right now, the biggest question is what would we do with it? And because we're not investors, we're advisors. We don't act as principal, we act as third-party advisors. But right now, interestingly, over the last 6 months, I've had far fewer inquiries about this simply because some of what we've seen, I think, in the SaaS industry, the model being sort of reset a little bit with the impact of AI, I think lots of third-party investors who previously were thinking about law firms are right now trying to think about what the future model looks like before deciding whether or not to invest. So I think there's a little bit of a pause in what was otherwise a very topical question up until even 6-9 months ago.
Got it. A different question, which is around London, and there were two thoughts I had here, is that, will London continue its sort of preeminent position as a dispute resolution center, but sort of, asking a second question, which is US law firms have been investing heavily in the UK whilst the capital markets have been moribund. So I'm asking you the first question and then I'm asking you to resolve this this question I can't quite answer.
Look, again, stepping back a second, Brexit 10 years ago now, who would have thought that the City of London would be in such a strong position today? I think the City of London as a whole has done a fantastic job about reinventing its position in the global economy today. And for us as a business, like any business, London, we just reflect, we just sort of follow where the markets are. You mentioned earlier, follow the capital. We follow the capital. London is one of the biggest, brightest, most exciting global financial centres of the world. So it's a hugely important market for us, but also a very successful market, for, I think, or for all investors. Any global organisation, be it a private, be it an asset manager, private equity firm, large corporate, investment bank, you name it, nobody would think seriously about not having a presence in London. Okay, so first of all, strength of London as a market is, I guess, well, London is stronger than ever as a market, and therefore for us remains an incredibly important market. So in a way, how do we fix London as a market? Generally, I think it's in a great shape. Capital flows coming in stronger than ever. So I'm very, very confident about London as a marketplace. I don't think there's much to fix at the moment.
Okay, and that question around dispute resolution?
Well, what is it? Why is London such an important centre for dispute resolution? It's the rule of law. Fundamental, the predictability of the English legal system means that parties around the world will continue to look to English courts, English arbitration as a way of settling their disputes because of the predictability of the outcome, because of the impartiality of the system, and because of the quality of the legal profession here. And I don't see that. There are other areas. I mean, Singapore, the Middle East, the US. Of course, there are other centres around the world, but London continues. And you can see, I think the US firms who have invested into London have done so very effectively, as you said, often in quite narrow areas. What they've done is they've picked their spot and then they've gone quite deep in a relatively narrow silo. So private equity is obviously one of those. We're seeing increased focus on dispute resolution now, litigation and arbitration here, but not... so yes, I think other firms are seeing that it's a great place to be, but not yet at the same scale as we're seeing in private equity here.
Great. Well, I am going to ask you five rapid fire questions. Number one, advice for young people thinking about the law profession.
Advice to a young person going to the legal profession, do it, lean in, be curious.
How do you relax?
I run.
What's the best book that you've read in the last year?
I'm reading, I have a very bad memory. I can remember nobody's names.
Okay. Don't worry, Philip.
I'm reading at the moment one that recommended to me recently, The Infinity Machine, which is a biography of the founder of DeepMind on AI. Fascinating.
Wow, okay. And is there one place in the world you haven't been to for holiday that you really want to go?
Australia.
Australia? Presumably you have quite a large practice there, don't you?
We don't, no.
No?
Very different market. We don't have a presence in Australia.
Is that typical of your competitive peers?
It's a market where there's some very strong firms locally. So we have great partnerships there, and we have great sort of, there are great firms with which we have partnerships. We work closely with them, but we don't actually have our own office there. And the reason is it's about as far away as I can imagine from anywhere else.
And as a friend who's just come back from having sailed around the world said, of all the places he wouldn't want to live is Australia because there's so many things that can kill you. So, and my final question...
I have my partners for that.
Okay. And my final question after that book, if you could say just one thing, one piece of advice, not to people listening from around the world, not legal advice, just the one piece of advice probably that you've learned.
So I've never had a master plan of what... for my career and also my life more generally, I've never had like a master plan of I must do this, etc. But I've always taken the sort of unpredictable. I've always sort of leaned into things as they happen and try to adapt. So I think just the ability to get on with things, adapt, not be put off when things go wrong. There is something to be said for sort of getting up every day in your personal life or in your professional life and getting on with things, that over time there's a compounding effect. It makes you stronger. You find enjoyment over things that first of all you find quite challenging. So what I enjoy the most is, I guess, is this sense of overcoming a challenge. Something that when I do something for the first time, I think, oh my God, how would I ever be able to do that? When you've done it a few times, it's immensely satisfying when you can turn a sort of a challenge or a failure into a success.
A version of what Tony Blair said when he came on, which was that he goes to bed at night and counts his blessings and wakes up in the morning with a sense of purpose. Alan, we had to wait a little bit to get you, over here in the studio, but it's terrific to see you again and to understand what I think even people who have been in the financial industry like myself for a very, very long time, you know, a lot of stuff that one doesn't really understand, and the absolute, you know, imperative for large firms operating in various parts of the world to have help with that complexity, the ability to work with firms in different locations, the importance of incorporating technology but not losing sight of the value of experience and judgment. And I hadn't really thought that, you know, as advisors, you're not capital starved, so anybody expecting suddenly lots of corporate activity in the legal space might be waiting a long time. So thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Simon.